got your attention now, don't I?
This is the Black Rifle Coffee Podcast.
For decades, buying a silencer has been difficult. But in 2005, Silencer Central set out to simplify the suppressor buying process. So whether you're planning your next hunt or putting together a range day, you'll enjoy every shot you take with Silencer Central, straight to your front door.
Awesome. So welcome to the Black Rifle Coffee Podcast. Today we have Joe Bartozzi, the CEO of NSSF and the ringleader, you would say, maybe of the SHOT Show.
The NSSF does own the SHOT Show, and we have a great team that puts it together for us, yeah.
Awesome. I usually start the show with how do you take your coffee. We hold nothing against you that you're not a coffee drinker.
You had to go there, right? That's how it's going to go? Okay.
Yeah, because bus chops a little bit.
I got
little
you.
Bit. Can you break down a little bit, NSSF, can you explain that one?
Yeah. The National Shooting Sports Foundation is a trade association. It's made up primarily of firearms, ammunition manufacturers, distributors, dealers, also accessory companies like scope manufacturers. We have media folks that are members of NSSF. Got about 10,000 plus members, representing about 400,000 American jobs, and representing about $70 billion in the economy for the United States. So
it's a big deal.
We are a business organization, not a consumer group, but we were created in 1961 to try and kind of remind people about the importance of hunting. There was a lot of anti-gun, anti-hunting movement going on in the early 60s, and so NSSF was created to try and give a voice to hunters and shooters and the industry.
Oh, that's fantastic. So I had quite the education based on our conversation yesterday, kind of leading up to the podcast today. I think it's amazing that collectively SHOT Show and you are supporting Black Rifle. We have that retail space, which is a first.
Yes.
And then also we'll have the podcast on Media Row doing some of the gear reviews and things like that, talking to some of the industry professionals. So for me and the rest of us, we appreciate that a lot.
Well, we're certainly very, very happy that you guys are with us. We know the power of the Black Rifle brand. We know the SHOT Show runs on coffee, present company excluded. but it's great. You guys, your marketing and everything, that is very strong, and I think it's a perfect fit for the audience and the community that we serve.
Yeah, absolutely. We have so much to get into, though. I mean, just based on our interactions and dinner and whatnot, you're on multiple boards that are pretty amazing. I'd like to break down some of that, and then we'll talk about where you're from and whatnot. But then also we'll kind of culminate with that suicide prevention initiative, which I think is fantastic. So for the listeners, stay tuned. We have multiple things to cover. But, Joe, where are you from? What did you do growing up?
Well, I am born and bred in Connecticut. Still live there. My family is all there. I started working in manufacturing back in the early 80s, and that's kind of was my first foray to the firearm industry. Is I was working for what they call a job shop, right? A company that made metal stampings for Ruger and Winchester, interestingly enough. So because I was already at that time a recreational shooter, my boss said, well, you're going to be the guy on the gun contracts because, you know the guns, you're a technical guy, and I was in quality control at that point. So I was able to go over to Ruger and Winchester, work with their engineers, work with their quality control folks, and it was a great first step into the industry. And interestingly enough, my grandfather spent 35 years with Winchester.
Oh, wow.
So to go back to the old factory where he worked many years before it was a really kind of emotional, it may sound crazy to some people, but it created this tie to my then deceased grandfather that I never had before, to be able to see what he saw and hear what he heard and see the machines and smell the cutting oil. It was a very powerful thing for me. So
in your DNA, and you're kind of
retapping
into that. That's really cool.
It was. And so that was my first real foray into the firearm industry. And then, of course, in 1986, I accepted a job with Mossberg and spent the next 32 years working at Mossberg.
Well, most people, maybe they do, maybe they don't know, but Connecticut had Winchester, Ruger, Mossberg, Colt, Marlin.
Yep.
Who's still there? We were just talking about that this
Mossberg
morning.
Mossberg still has a factory there. Colt has a presence, although I don't know to what extent they're doing manufacturing there. But as far as manufacturing purely, Ruger has headquarters in Connecticut, but no more factory. The Winchester plant is long gone. The original plant and the new one is vacant now. I don't know what they're doing with that, but they moved their operations out of Connecticut. Marlin is gone, long gone now. So I don't really. There's a Connecticut shotgun company there. Whether they're still there in Hartford or not, I don't know anymore.
Interesting.
But it's not what it was.
I mean, that's a lot of manufacturers all in one place.
And by the way, Remington, at one point in time, Remington Ammunition had 3 million square feet of manufacturing space in Connecticut. And that's all gone.
That's
closed up and gone. So it's for the economy of Connecticut, for the communities that those factories were in, it's a big deal. And it was devastating to those people. You know, manufacturing supports a lot of other industries. No one really talks about that. But when you have manufacturing, you've got people coming in, traveling in and out for business. There's restaurants, hotels, all sorts of service industries. I mean, I know Mossberg, we had so many vendors in Connecticut that make pins, springs, plastic parts, you know, you name it. If those companies move away, they take their vendor base.
Right.
You know, those guys, they'll find new vendors closer to where they are for logistics.
It's a more systemic impact than you'd think when those big industries, those big companies move out.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a big deal, and it's a sad state of affairs, frankly.
So where did you start in Mossberg? 32 years. We got some things to cover. This is pretty exciting.
I started Mossberg as a quality engineer. I really wanted to be a quality engineer. That was kind of the next job evolution for me. So I left the job shop, went over to Mossberg, and it was a great education for me, working out in the factory, working with the guys that made the parts, that assembled, that designed. It gave me a kind of a full view of the entire factory and the logistics of the whole plant. And then from there, I became the manager of the quality department for the whole company. And then a few years later, they promoted me to plant manager. So I was running the entire factory for about three or four years and then ran product service for a few years. And then I just, had the opportunity to go to law school and went at night. So I went 4 years at night at law school while I worked during the day in the shop and in product service and such.
What was the motivation for you to do law school?
I was doing some work with the legal department because of my background in quality and manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And when they got involved in technical matters of a legal nature, product liability claims, things like that, they would work with me on the quality plans, how we design, how we test our products. And that was, my first interaction with attorneys. You know, no one in my family was a lawyer, and I've worked in a factory, for years and years. But I had this first opportunity to meet and work with outside counsel as well as in-house counsel for Mossberg, and they put me up for depositions, and they had me, give expert written testimony, and so it kind of gave me a little bit of an insight into that. And I was actually on a business trip in Texas. I got a call from Ivor Mossberg and said, hey, we would like to have a succession plan for our general counsel position. Would you be interested in working in the legal department, going to law school? And I was blown away.
That's an amazing offer, right?
And his support, the entire company, the Mossberg family, Alan, Ivor, Jonathan, their support was tremendous for me. And they put me through law school at night. I worked during the day, graduated in 01, passed the bar in Connecticut. And I became a corporate attorney at that point. And then 3 years later, they promoted me to vice president and general counsel.
That's awesome. Well, you're truly the subject matter expert, though, on the things that you have to address by having the background and now the education to be able to have the legal speak, if you will.
It was a very important thing, I think, and a good model. I think it was a very insightful approach because when you're dealing with legal matters of a technical nature, you want to know more than their experts.
Right.
And having somebody that worked in the factory that, spent years, working with the assemblers, working with the testers, doing the, writing up the quality plans to make sure that the goods coming into the factory, the raw materials are to standard, and then going out the door 100% inspection on all the shotguns and rifles, that's a big deal. And
huge.
There was no expert that was going to pull the wool over my eyes because I did it. I lived it every day.
Right. Well, it's brilliant, actually, to, promote and educate from within the company and create somebody that's the absolute expert. Yeah, right. Very cool. So I'm curious. Mossberg was primarily shotguns initially. Rifles became a little bit more prevalent.
Correct.
But we were talking last night, and you educated me on a concealed carry pistol that they're doing now. So what was that like to watch the evolution of Mossberg in innovation and, kind of keeping up almost with the rest of the industry because it's been growing quite a bit.
It was, I think Mossberg in a lot of ways was a very progressive company in its early years.
Mm-hmm.
It became very, very famous for the Model 500 shotgun.
Absolutely.
And that was where they had to promote a lot of that production or dedicate a lot of that production to the Model 500 to keep up with the orders. As they grew in capacity, we opened up a new facility in Texas, which gave us more capacity to grow and do more machining and assembly. They had more opportunities. So rifles came in to play, bolt-action rifles, modern sporting rifles they made there for several years. And then towards the end of my tenure at Mossberg, they started developing a polymer striker-fired pistol.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was involved on intellectual property, patent searches, even as a shooter, as a competitive shooter myself, ergonomics. This, how does this feel? What type of features should we have? What type of manual of arms should it incorporate? How should it disassemble, you know, to make sure it's appropriate for the user, the consumer, right? We look at what the consumer needs.
It's a very thoughtful approach.
It's a very thoughtful approach. Mm-hmm. We had a very good, diverse crew working on the development. So it wasn't just another Me Too. I think it was a very well thought out, well designed pistol. And they've added to the product line. So now it's not just subcompact. Now they have a more full size pistol. And I think a carry gun that people are very interested in. I know they are because they've been selling them very well, I understand.
And what model is that?
It's MS1, and then they have the MS1SC. I think there's also an MS2 now.
I feel like I know a guy that might be able to help me get my grippers on those at SHOT Show
check it out. I may know a guy.
So your personal shooting background, you said you mm-hmm. started as kind of a sports shooter when you were younger, got involved with Mossberg. What was that evolution like? Because last night you said you've even done 3-gun and things like that.
I started out shooting trap.
Makes a lot of sense.
I'll never forget. This is way before Mossberg.
Okay.
It was January and was cold, cold, cold. And the Remington had a beautiful gun club right on Long Island Sound. It was the Lordship Gun Club. It was a gorgeous place.
Oh, very cool.
And a couple of the guys I worked with at my first job in manufacturing, they say, hey, on a whim, they said, let's go to the gun club and go shooting. At that time, you can go there, rent a gun, and buy a box of shells. It was like $2 for a box of shells, and they'd loan you the gun.
Dirt cheap.
Yeah, so there was a bunch of us going to go. The weather was so cold, only two of us showed up, myself and one other guy. We went to the club, and on my first round of trap ever, I broke 16 out of 25.
Oh, wow.
And the instructor was like, oh, you've done this before. I said, I've never picked up a shotgun in my life.
Right.
And not that I'm a great shotgun shooter. I mean, I can hold my own, you know, but that was that, you know, doing well out of the gate, I think, on the first round of trap gave me incentive. So now I bought a Winchester shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
I started shooting, going on the weekends. After work on Saturdays, I'd run over to Lordship. I'd shoot a couple rounds of trap, and that was kind of my thing. And my uncle would take me out with his rifles. We'd shoot rifles. And then I got into skeet, sporting clays, handgun, IDPA shooting. I really like that very much.
Oh, nice.
And then 3-gun.
What class were you shooting in IDPA?
I don't know. The gun club that I belonged to had a Thursday night league.
Okay.
And they had all range of shooters coming in, and I did fairly well. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I really did.
That's awesome. So, little secret about me, unless it's breaching a door or maybe killing a woodchuck, I'm terrible with a shotgun.
You just need a little teaching. That's all.
Yeah, I just need a little coaching.
A little coaching. That's all.
Were the matches all up there, Connecticut, doing 3-gun? Did you travel a little bit?
We did some traveling. I've shot all over the country in various competitions. We shot in the Sportsman's Team Challenge was a kind of a precursor to the formal 3-gun.
Mm-hmm.
Those were held around the country. We shot the Nationals in Florida and in Texas. Mossberg came in third place in industry one year, the last year we had our team together. That was really cool.
I met some of the Mossberg team at a shoot in Bend, Oregon. It was a 3-gun. Shoot, or maybe it was a sponsorship or something like that. But
probably so.
Yeah, just awesome.
But
machines.
we had some good shooters then, and now, of course, they still do.
Mm-hmm.
But so that was really fun. I enjoyed that because pistol, rifle, and shotgun, and a variety of scenarios. It was it was great. So yeah, I've shot all around the country, and it's something that I'm passionate about doing.
Yeah.
All three of my kids can pick up a shotgun and handle it pretty well.
So the concealed carry conversation that we had, we got to review that a little bit. I didn't expect you to be like, yes, I've got like four different types of concealed carry depending on. Well, talk me through that thought process because people don't think about it very often.
Well,
of like what type of clothing am I wearing? You know, is it a winter jacket type of situation? I think it was a brilliant conversation.
I have three or four handguns that I would consider my primary concealed carry firearms. I probably have twice as many holsters.
Of course.
Right?
All right.
Because always. Inside the waistband, outside the waistband, mm-hmm. sticky holsters for the pocket. Again, in Connecticut, we have four seasons. So if I'm wearing a sweater or a light jacket, a certain holster, a certain combination is more suited to concealing it properly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in summer when it's hot and you're wearing a pair of shorts, a sticky holster inside the pocket is probably the way to go.
That's the Black Widow, right? The little 22 mag.
Yeah, the little NAA revolvers. Sure, yeah. That's one of my four that I would go to. I mean, yeah. But you know, it depends on how I feel. It depends on what I feel proficient in. I've got two semis. I've got two revolvers that I would interchange depending on where I'm going, how I'm dressed,
right.
And just you know how I feel that day. It's the problem with having more than one concealed carry gun is you got to stay proficient with them. Mm-hmm. Obviously, understand the manual of arms on all the styles, which you have to do. But it also it's like I like the variety. I like Ruger LCR, the Mossberg MC1. Mm-hmm. I have a Browning 380 1911, which is a pretty cool carry gun.
Very cool. It seems like you're very purpose driven and like you know making sure that. The weapon, obviously, you have to be proficient and train with it and everything mm-hmm. else in order, especially when you're switching platforms.
Correct.
But if you train it enough, in conjunction with having the best capability for a concealed firearm based on the clothing, attire, everything else, I think it's important for people to think about that.
Right. You know? Being able to have access to it so it's mm-hmm. not jammed up in your clothing, depending on that would make difference, like what kind of holster I'm wearing or,
absolutely.
You know, what gun I particularly carry that day, you know, a high, you know, pancake style or something a little more lower down and inside the waistband. Just depends on, you know.
Yeah, how awesome. It goes. So you finished up in Mossberg. What year was that?
When I left Mossberg?
Mm-hmm.
I left Mossberg in 2018, September of 2018.
Okay. And then was there an interim or were you going to NSSF after that?
There was no interim. I stayed. I had provided notice to the Mossbergs in August that I had accepted a position with NSSF. I stayed. They asked me to stay on and help identify the next general counsel.
Yeah, a handover of sorts.
So I knew some guys. I stayed. I did some interviews with some potential candidates. We had great candidates come in and interview for the job. I was very pleased with the response that we received. And then I literally left Mossberg on a Friday, and then I started Monday at NSSF.
What was that like?
I think it was okay because I had served on the Board of Governors for NSSF for about 10 years prior to going over there.
Mm-hmm.
I was the secretary of the corporation. I was the chairman of the nominating committee. I was the chairman of the finance committee when I left Mossberg for NSSF.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, and by the way, living in Connecticut, I was a frequent visitor to the NSSF offices when I had to deal with budget issues or things like that.
Right.
So I was like the only board member lived in Connecticut at the time. So it was convenient for me. So I was familiar with – everyone knew me, and I knew everybody there at the company. So I think it was a very comfortable transition. And of course, the CEO then stayed on for mm-hmm. almost another year.
So you stepped in as the CEO.
I stepped in as president.
Okay.
But he was still the CEO. So
gotcha.
He relinquished the president title, and I took the president's title. He remained CEO until he retired, I think, December 31st of 2019, I think was his last day.
Okay.
And then I became CEO and president of both NSSF and also SAMI, which is the Sporting Arms and Ammunition Manufacturers Institute. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, I was chairman of the board of SAMI before transitioning over as an employee of SAMI. So this whole mm-hmm. thing is, it was kind of strange how it worked out. I was actually on the search committee for the replacement CEO.
Oh, interesting.
As part of the executive committee of the board, our function was to hire and fire the CEO. That was the executive committee, one of their roles. And I worked with hiring an outside recruiting firm to find the next CEO. I helped write the job description.
Very intimately involved in that.
I was very intimately involved with that. So, but again, as a Mossberg employee, but doing my duty as a board member to NSSF, I'm always very careful when I take on any board responsibility. I don't just do it in name only.
Right.
I don't just put my name on I'm on the board, but I mean, if I'm going to be on the board, I'm going to be actively involved. And I was a very active board member. So I was engaged in the process from the get-go. And I remember I would talk to the recruiter, you know, how's it going? Did we find anybody? I'd give him a couple of names. Hey, here's some people that I think you might want to talk to. And one day he calls me and he goes, Joey, he said, you know, I know we've been talking about some potential candidates. He goes, but I got to tell you, everybody that I talk to says you're the guy for that job. Hmm. And I was like, I thought he was kidding. I laughed it off. I thought he was joking with me. Right. You know, I really didn't. I really hadn't considered leaving Mossberg. Had a great career with a great company, a great family. It's a family business, which made you feel at home.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, there's something about that I valued very much.
It's like here. You feel like you're part of a family.
Yeah. So, you know, it wasn't something that ever crossed my mind. But when he said it, that other people in the industry were talking about me as a candidate, at least I had to consider the fact that it's possible it might be something that I would be interested in.
Right.
Not that I was looking to leave, but in terms of challenging yourself to grow, mm-hmm. like I had done an awful lot in my career. I mean, I had been all over the world for Mossberg. You know, again, you know, we talked about, I didn't mention I was the VP of operations for Mossberg International. So mm-hmm. working with all of our international suppliers and the whole product line for Mossberg International, that was my responsibility. So I had a breadth of knowledge, having visited gun factories on three continents, you know, in my career, plus you know, the United States. So I had a pretty well-rounded view of the world, but mm-hmm. I said, I've had a lot of bosses. What kind of boss would I be if I was a CEO? You know, would I be the boss that people want, or that I would want to have myself?
Right.
And so I thought it would be an opportunity to challenge myself. So at that point, I put my name in the running. I recused myself from all activities dealing with the CEO search. And let that play out, and they're gonna find whoever they're gonna find. But at least let them know that here's my resume. You know, I will at least consider the opportunity if it's available. And went through the whole process like every other candidate went through the process. Mm-hmm. And I was offered the job. And when I was, it was like, oh, now is a decision point.
Oh yeah.
Because again, you I was it, running away from Mossberg. I had a job that I really liked.
Right.
Now I had a real. So I called the family together. Said, look, here's the situation. I got this offer. It's a very different role for me. I'm not going to be practicing law like I was. I really enjoyed the legal aspect of my job. But it gives me an opportunity to kind of put my touch on an industry, not just a one company organization, right? This company, NSF, deals with the entire industry.
I didn't realize how big it is. And we can unpack some of that. Mm-hmm. Can we unpack Sammy just a little bit? Because I don't think a lot of people understand like all that they're doing for the gun industry.
Yeah, Sammy is really important. I mean, Sammy was started in 1926 at the request of Congress. Post-World War I, there was a lot of concern because ammunition and guns weren't always compatible, even though they were of the same caliber or mm-hmm. cartridge. And that's a problem, obviously.
Oh, 100%.
Coming out of World War I, you know, you're making ammo here, I'm making guns there. If they don't go together, you have reliability and safety issues. So Congress said, look, you guys are the experts in this. Create standards for cartridges and chambers, safety, reliability, interchangeability, things like that. Mm-hmm. So SAMI is the technical standard setting organization for the industry. So every new cartridge that comes out that is introduced through SAMI is vetted by a group of industry experts from the various companies, including the company that introduces the cartridge. So you take a cartridge like, I don't know, the 350 Legend, mm-hmm. you know, that I remember that very well, being on the committee at SAMI, you know, seeing that process start to finish. You know, your concept comes in from a member company, then all the drawings have to be created, you have to do all the tolerance studies, then the chambers have to be designed around the cartridge, and it's a very, very important thing. And then, of course, there are drop test mm-hmm. Standards that SAMI puts out. Regulatory compliance with regard to shipping ammunition, shipping gunpowder, shipping guns, all runs through SAMI to make sure they're up to speed on what's the latest for, let's say, an airline is going to ship gunpowder or a ship is going to ship ammunition. There's all these crazy rules, very important safety rules. Mm-hmm. SAMI gets that, works with the various agencies, and disseminates that information to the industry so that they can comply with the shipping regulations for all those component parts and gunpowder, primers, and things like that.
Yeah, it's super important, but I think a lot of people don't think about, you know, behind the scenes, who is regulating all this.
It's a very, very highly technical thing, and I have to tell you that the people that work on the SAMI committees from the various companies, our staff at SAMI, they are literally the best in the world. There is nobody in the world that I've worked with, and I've worked with the folks from Europe, all over the world on this. There's nobody better than our folks here in the U.S. on these type of things.
Yeah, that's great.
They are true experts, they are passionate, and they're innovative, and it's an honor, you know, I've worked on SAMI committees for 30 years. When I was at Mossberg, I was on the Joint Technical Committee and on firearms, you know, so my technical background was served me very well there. But now I'm looking at it from the top, you know, from the entire international work, the, you know, SLARAC, which is the logistics and shipping regulations, and of course, Joint Technical. So it's like, wow, this is
it's huge.
Even stuff I didn't know, even as chairman of the board, stuff I didn't know was going on. So it's fascinating, and it's very, very important. It's a very, very important thing.
So can you explain for me and the listeners how NSSF and SHOT Show, like how that whole thing works and, you know, supports the industry?
Yeah, the SHOT Show is probably the most well-known thing we do because it's a huge event every year.
Gigantic.
But it's one of several programs that we have to support the industry. But since you mentioned SHOT Show, it started in 1979 in St. Louis. Probably, I think there were about 5,600 people there at that show now. And now we will average about 55,000 to come to a show.
So huge.
It's been in numerous different cities, including, believe it or not, the second SHOT Show was held in San Francisco, I believe.
Oh,
well, yeah,
really?
Go figure. Yeah.
Not anymore.
Yeah. But we've had shows in Atlanta, in Dallas. We've had shows in Orlando.
When was your first show?
My first show was, I think, 1992. And I want to say it might have been Dallas. I think it was Dallas.
Okay.
I have to go back and check my notes on that. But I think it was Dallas. But I've been to Vegas. We had it at the convention center. And then they moved over to the Sands more recently. But it's been in Vegas now for the last several years because it just – we know from the statistics, we know from the response to the show, the registration numbers, the traffic at the show, Las Vegas always outperforms the other cities.
Right. It's designed that way.
It's just designed. It has the infrastructure, the hotels, the restaurants. It just is really good. I mean, a lot of great venues. Don't get me wrong. Orlando was nice. Atlanta was nice. But to get to the convention center was a hump. You had to get in a cab. The hotels are downtown. The convention center is further out, whatever. With Vegas, it's just works, and the Clark County folks have been great to work with. All the Metro, LV Metro are great. The FBI locally have been great for security purposes. It's been a great relationship. And by the way, the show brings in almost $90 million in non-gaming revenue to the city, so it's very important to the local economy there as well.
Wow,
it's important to us, obviously.
Of course.
It pays for the programs and services we do for the industry.
Mm-hmm. Black Rifle Coffee Company set out on a mission to make the best cup of coffee that's ever hit your mug. The dream was to sell enough premium coffee to be able to build a support network of veterans, first responders, and law enforcement. Thanks to your support, all that dream has become a reality. Black Rifle Coffee is roasted by a veteran-led team of brilliant coffee graders here in the United States who work tirelessly to roast and bag the highest quality coffee right here in America. The coffee is truly one of a kind, but it's your support that gets the gear, funding, and supplies into the hands of those on our front lines. This year alone, your support has helped BRCC expand our team of active duty service members, veterans, and veteran family members. Black Rifle was also able to donate over 120,000 bags of coffee to veterans and first responders in 2022, all thanks to you. You can purchase at blackriflecoffee.com. You can also find Black Rifle Coffee in grocery and convenience stores near you. Black Rifle Coffee, America's coffee.
For decades, buying a silencer has been difficult. But in 2005, Silencer Central set out to simplify the suppressor buying process. So what happens when you buy from Silencer Central? Well, they help you find the right silencer for you. They handle the paperwork so you don't have to. And they give you a free NFA gun trust so you can share your suppressor. Silencer Central allows you to pay while you wait. They make sure your purchase is carefully prepped, packaged, and protected until the moment you're approved. Once approved, they deliver it straight to your door. So whether you're planning your next hunt or putting together a range day, you'll enjoy every shot you take with Silencer Central, straight to your front door.
But it also helps the local economy and, you know, the union folks out there. We have a great relationship with the union guys that help build up all of our staging and all of our booths and whatnot. So it's a great relationship. We are very, very proud and hold those folks in Vegas in very high esteem.
Yeah, absolutely. How many SHOT Shows have you been to?
I want to say 24.
Wow.
This might be 25. Again, I have a pin from every SHOT Show.
Oh, nice.
And I have them stuck in a giant like hat.
Yeah.
And I go every once in a while. I go back and I count them. And I check off the years, but this might be 25.
And so, how have you seen the evolution of SHOT Show? Like watching it grow.
Yeah, I mean, it's changed quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's changed from, I guess, early on, it was a very hunting centric show because SHOT stands for shooting, hunting, and outdoor trade show.
Mm-hmm.
And early on, I would say, in my view, it was a very hunter centric show. Lately, it's much more involved in law enforcement, tactical type products because that's what is popular today. The modern sporting rifle, for example, has become such an iconic piece of Americana. People shoot that platform because it's comfortable, it's accurate, it's lightweight, it's modular, all of these things. And companies, Mossberg and others, are developing platforms around that gun. So they're seeing a lot more of those at the show now. There was a time back in the early 2010, 2014, where there was a thought that bigger was better. So the show mushroomed to almost 70,000 people. The problem is the exhibitors are there to conduct business. It's not a consumer show.
Right.
They're there to have meetings, conduct business with their customers, with their suppliers, with prospective partners. I know, working at Mossberg, that we would meet regularly with folks with ideas, concepts for new products, and that was a very valuable part of our experience at SHOT Show. So you would get at times a lot of what we call tire kickers or trick-or-treaters that would just want to come out and you know, handle the guns,
right.
But they weren't buyers. They weren't
just looky-loos.
They were just looky-loos.
Yeah.
And, you know, not to disparage that, as an exhibitor, it was a tremendous drain on our resources and our time. Because we're there to meet with customers and vendors and, you know, international partner, whatever. And looky-loos, they would have no qualms about taking up 15, 20 minutes bending your ear on something. Me and my brother-in-law will buy one of these.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I got to sell 100,000 of them.
Right.
You know, you can't make a product for two people, you know, so.
Well, you're looking for the bigger, you know, the bigger clients. You have to do the numbers.
You're setting your program for the year.
Mm-hmm.
You're setting your production capacity for the entire year. You're buying raw materials based upon your feedback from SHOT Show. So you've got to get the right information and you got to get it quickly and accurately. So then the NSSF started to really scrutinize and scrub the list of who was getting into the show.
Okay.
You know, we want buyers. Right now we've got thousands of buyers registered for this show from about 100 countries around the world. That's really good. We've got thousands of media coming in because part of what the SHOT Show is good for and valuable for as an exhibitor is getting exposure to the mass market and to the outside world.
Right.
So that's a very important consideration. Make sure we have the right media folks there. Make sure we don't have the wrong media folks there.
Well, and I think from the outside perspective, just from, you know, my understanding of SHOT Show, I didn't realize that it wasn't consumer-based. Because you see so many reviews coming across, and you guys are checking out new kit and new gear, so the clarification of like, no, this is actually for our exhibitors to do deals, that it just changes the perspective of the show.
Right.
Which is giving back so much to the community also.
It's, you know, the show is a business-to-business show. It's mm-hmm. for our members. Everything that we do for them, the exhibitors, and also the attendees, the buyers and the media folks particularly, but there's others as well. We've got a lot of partners, you know, a lot of these conservation groups are tremendous partners to the industry. You know, they're gonna be in force at the SHOT Show. We've got a number of different non-for-profits coming in. So those are very important, and ATF comes in.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI NICS folks come in because our members and our exhibitors and our attendees want to talk about a particular issue with a form or a document or a time to get a form approved through the system. You know, so having ATF there, having FBI there is really important to get real face-to-face human contact.
Well, and it's real time.
It's real time.
Yeah, that's
and
super valuable.
The other thing that's valuable about the show is, unlike a lot of other products, I think a firearm is a very tactile thing. How do you look at a shotgun on a picture or online and say, how is it going to point? How is it going to balance? But at the SHOT Show, you get to see the latest and greatest, and you could actually see, is this something my customer, if I'm a retailer or a distributor, is this something my customers would like? You know, and can I make a can I sell these properly to my customer base, to my consumer base? You can do that by handling it, seeing it, you know, feeling it.
I think most tacticians are tactile people.
Yeah.
And you need to put your hands on it. You know, last year I was looking at different concealed guns and whatnot, just to see how they handled, how they point, how, what the features feel like, you know, stippling, sights. So, like you said, when we talked about, you can look at all the pictures in the world, you can even have the 360 thing, but until you actually touch it, feel it, you know, see the pointability and everything
weight.
Else.
I mean, all these things factor in. So I think the show is highly relevant in that regard. You have to, you've got to be able to feel this thing, this product, of course. And again, being able to expose that to the outside world through the media, it allows the consumers to live kind of vicariously through that without having to burden unnecessarily the exhibitors with, you know, we could have 200,000 people at the SHOT Show.
Right.
And it would be overwhelming and overcrowded. But it is a business-to-business show. We do intend to keep it that way, even though it evolves every year with new and different approaches to try and make it better every year. The SHOT Show, it may be 4 days in January to most of the world, but to us, it's 12 months out of the year. It's a 12-month project. We start working on the SHOT Show before we even leave the current SHOT Show.
Right. I mean, it's so hard to wrap my head around just how big that machine is that takes to put those 4 days on. Yeah.
It's a nonstop, full-time job for our crew, and we have a great crew. They do a tremendous job, and the moving parts, again, as a board member, I saw some of that, but you don't really see it or don't really appreciate it until you are responsible for all of it and see what your folks have to go through every day with, I mean, like I said, security issues, somebody getting belligerent on the show floor or somebody is being accused of stealing intellectual property. Or I mean, there's all of these things you wouldn't even think about. You know, so we've got great relationships, like I said, with the local law enforcement. Our team is very tied in with the various groups in the area to help make sure we have a safe show, an effective show, and a highly relevant experience for our exhibitors and our attendees. And we aim to do that. And every year, at the end of the show, the entire executive team for NSSF takes the show floor, divides it up on a map, and then each one of us go out to the exhibitors in our zone, and we ask, how did it go? What could we do better? What would you like to see changed? And we do an after-action report, and then we follow up with a survey to all attendees and exhibitors. And then we crunch that data right through February into March. And then we have a plan for the, you know, to really nail down the next SHOT Show and include as many improvements as we possibly can make.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, just to have, you know, the ability to get that kind of real-time feedback like we talked about, but then implement it right away to make the show better, you know, the next year. I have to ask, I hate bringing up COVID stuff, but I'm thinking about the fact that the industry collectively relies on this show for business deals. And I was there last year, and there was a lot less numbers.
Right.
Do you think that it affected the industry because of the limitations with COVID and everything else during that time frame? Or I guess the last even 2 years. I didn't go to the one prior.
The 2020 show was pre-COVID, and it was a great show. The of course the 21 show was canceled because of COVID. The 22 show, we had a probably 30% less attendees. We had some exhibitors that did not come. It was ironic though, to kind of in a roundabout way get to your
sure.
The show floor was less crowded. So I literally had exhibitors come to me and say, this is great. Keep it at these levels. Keep it at these levels because we can actually hear ourselves talk. We can have better meetings. We have a much more meaningful.
We can get around a little bit easier.
I mean, of course, we really can't do that. I mean, that might be cutting it too much.
Right.
But I think because of the circumstances that were going on, you had not only COVID, you had a presidential election in 20, which, you know, bled over into a Democrat House, Senate, and president, which drive sales. You had civil unrest, which absolutely drove sales. So I think if there was ever a year that the industry was able to get away a little bit with a reduced SHOT Show, it was the last year.
Yeah, makes a lot of
sense. Because sales were very, very strong. And the numbers, I just saw the recent NICS numbers for, I think it was the fourth quarter numbers for this year were the third highest on record.
NICS?
NIC, I'm sorry, National Instant Criminal Background Check System.
Oh.
That is when you go to buy a gun, you do in most, not all states, but in many states, you have to go through the NICS background check system. And now, while it's not a perfect indicator of gun sales to background checks, it's a very, very strong indicator. There's a very strong correlation between the number of background checks done and the number of guns sold.
Right.
So we see that even in spite of the fact that the market appears to be softening a little bit, is still the third strongest quarter, third strongest fourth quarter, I should say, in NICS history.
Oh, wow.
So still very, very robust sales. And I think, you know, with the addition of millions, 15 to 20 million first-time gun buyers in the last 3 years, 2.5 to 3 years alone, the new normal of normal gun sales is going to be higher than the old normal. And again, being in the industry for 35 years, I've seen this kind of this, you know, this ebb and flow of sales. And but the last, I would say the last decade has been unprecedented in terms of continual growth. And, you know, right now, like I said, when that thing levels out, when that sales trend levels out, it's still going to be higher than what we've ever seen it before. I'm quite certain of that.
I think it's fascinating, especially your perspective, having been in the industry for so long and obviously in these, you know, critical roles throughout. It's pretty awesome to hear. Yeah. So you talked about other programs that NSSF and SHOT Show, you know, drive some of the revenue, I'm assuming, and whatnot from the show into. Can we unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so what we talk about in our mission statement is we promote, protect, and preserve hunting and the shooting sports.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we're a member organizations, our members, companies, not individuals. But what a lot of people don't know is, for example, we communicate. We have public-facing websites. Letsgoshooting.org, Letsgohunting.org. Gun Owners Care is a passion of mine because it shows people in our industry doing good for their communities. Who's supporting the Red Cross? Who's making hand sanitizer? Who's making masks? Who's donating time during COVID? It was a particularly important thing. Who's supporting cancer research? We try to highlight those stories on Gun Owners Care because the industry, frankly, never gets a fair shake in the media. So we're trying to generate our own. These are good stories. These are important things that people are doing in their own communities throughout this country. I feel like our industry is very generous. It's very caring, great people. And I'm trying to highlight those good stories.
I think it's brilliant. And let me equate it because I think it resonates with our audience. People who don't do jiu-jitsu, as an example, or they haven't gone into, you know, a gym. It's very intimidating from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you're there with the professors and the group and the family and the community, all of a sudden you realize, like, these scary people are actually some of the nicest people on the planet. They are very giving and generous. And I think that, you know, the firearms community collectively is that thing. So that's awesome that you have something to highlight those stories.
Right.
Because, you know, the one negative thing can really hurt us collectively, but it's the one that makes the media, you know?
The media will only cover the negative on our industry. It's just the way it is. For example, one of the things that we are very proud of is Project ChildSafe. Some folks may have heard of that. This program has been around for about 22 years, 23 years now. We have given away 40 million safety kits, which include a gun lock, all 50 U.S. states, all 5 U.S. territories, through our law enforcement and other community partners, have given away these free locking devices so that we want to prevent accidents, misuse, theft, suicide. This is a positive story.
Oh, 100%.
And so we're trying. That's one of our programs that people might be familiar with. But again, the mainstream media is not going to talk about that. We've got a program called "Don't Lie for the Other Guy," you know, which is for our retailers to prevent straw purchases. People come in and say, "I'm buying this gun," but they're really buying it for their buddy who's a convicted felon.
Right.
We have a program which We work in partnership with the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives.
Mm.
To educate the retailers on how to spot and prevent and stop these straw purchases, again, keeping guns out of the wrong hands.
Interesting. What's the tactic on that?
The tactic for
It's for spotting that the straw handler, the guy that's
someone on a cell phone, talking to somebody while they're looking at a gun. Somebody walking and saying, I don't even know what that is. I just want that.
So it's really a little human intelligence that they're looking for.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah, interesting.
We're teaching people how to interact with their customers.
Mm-hmm.
To ask them questions, engage them.
Yeah,
you know, not to be intrusive. You don't want to be intrusive. Obviously, there's a privacy issue here, but you know when something doesn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a retailer, and again, wonderful people, the first line of defense, against people getting guns that shouldn't have them is the retailer, right? And again, yes, they don't get any credit for that. They only catch the blame when something bad happens, but they are literally the first line of defense.
That's very interesting.
So they come in and we show them. We have video training videos and we say, now look, you know your baseline customer. You know how to have a conference. Just if it doesn't feel right, there's no law says you have to transfer that gun on that day.
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, we, you know, as a trade association, we want to promote gun sales.
Of course.
But the right gun sales. And there are, like it or not, there are prohibiting elements that the federal law and state laws provide. And we want to comply with those laws. So here's how you can help comply with those laws, keep guns out of the wrong hands. And by the way, here's a big card you put on the counter warning people, by the way, we're on to you guys.
Right.
Don't try it here. Go someplace else.
Yeah, that whole human kind of angle. I mean, I've done multiple trainings for that, like reading body posture and whatnot. Mm-hmm. You know, TSA does portions of that. I think that there's some other countries where, Israel specifically, they are fantastic at reading people and just pulling them right out of a line when they feel that kind of nefarious behavior. I'd never thought about it in that application, which is brilliant.
So again, unless you're in the retail space, you might not even notice it. If you go to a gun shop, you might not notice it. For most people, it'll never affect them.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a certain element out there that's trying to obtain guns illegally, and we're trying to stop that.
Yeah, super noble.
We have Operation Secure Store, which is another program for physical security. We see it happen in my own town, where a guy steals a car, him and his buddies drive it through the front of the gun shop, run in, steal what they can, and get out quickly.
We've all seen the videos. Yeah.
It's a horrible thing. It's a frightening thing. And again, we're working with ATF on hardening retail stores so that this is prevented. And we know from working with ATF that and getting the numbers from them that thefts and burglars are down, which is really good because we're hardening, giving people ideas about how to harden it. We have people go out and audit the store, do it a checklist. Hey, check this. Maybe you want to put a bollard here or do something here, change the way you have that set up because, you know, there's vulnerabilities here, perhaps.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's another good program. And of course, we have Fix Nix, which is what we learned is that for all of the media griping about background checks, universal background checks, a lot of states were not putting disqualifying records into the background check system.
Oh.
So you'd go to a gun shop, get a background check, but it was incomplete.
Yeah, it didn't show up.
That's a problem.
Of course.
I mean, it's a real problem. So we literally changed the law in 16 states.
Oh, wow.
To have them include that information. As it should be.
And I mean, just so it's said, like, gun owners and enthusiasts, and I mean, I've been slinging guns and doing my whole life. We all want the purchases done correctly, the background checks done correctly, the correct transfer paperwork and everything. You know, it's not a cowboy situation. It's follow the rules, you know, and then enjoy your sport or your hunting.
We could argue the rules
when we do,
right? We push back against bad laws all the time. That's part of our job. But when the rules are there and they're there for a reason, you have to comply with them. Otherwise, you'll be shut down, right? But when a state will complain about the industry and then fail to include those disqualifying records.
Seems a little hypocritical.
It's a little hypocritical. Yeah. So we went out and said, okay, I won't mention any states, but we changed the laws in 16 of them, and some of them are bluest of the blue.
Yeah. That's huge, though.
It is helping make a better quality background check. Again, with the intention of keeping guns out of the wrong hands.
And that's what it's all about. Yeah. Amazing. That's a lot of programs. So what I'm going to have to do is...
That's not even all of them. But
you can keep going. I love this because I want to put it in the show notes so that people can see and click through to some of these things and educate themselves after this conversation. What do we miss?
Well, I want to talk a little bit about our suicide prevention program.
That's the one I love.
It's something that was started about 5 or 6 years ago. We work with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and more recently working with the Department of Veterans Affairs to help prevent suicide by firearm. And we do that by creating documents and trainings, and we distribute those freely out to anybody. We have online resources available because our community, the gun-owning community, does tend to get stigmatized about these types of things. But also, I know from the perspective of, in my own personal life, I witnessed a suicide. I had suicide in my family.
I'm sorry, it's tragic.
Both of my sons are veterans, and I know the statistics of veteran suicide. So,
and I would argue that those statistics are not as accurate as we think, because they're talking about service members. I don't think they equate for the guy that got out 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Yeah. I had a friend attempt suicide within the last couple of weeks. He's in his 60s. I don't think those numbers are being counted as right. well. So they're skewed. You know, what is the number, 23? I'll get some hate for not knowing the number right off the top of my head, but I think the number is way higher because just in my little realm of the world, suicide is rampant, and it is an extreme problem, and it is preventable with education and intervention.
Suicide is higher amongst veterans. We know that, the mm-hmm. veteran community. So we also know, and I learned this through my working with AFSP and the VA, is suicide is preventable. Mm-hmm. That concept cannot be overstated. And for me, as an engineer, when something is preventable, now that means I can do something about it.
100%.
So what we're trying to do is to bring our community, the gun-owning community, and the doctors together in some way. Because I know this, there has been a bias against guns in some medical communities. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I know, that gun guys can smell BS and bias a million miles away.
100%, yep.
And as I, you know, we spoke with the VA and others, say, if your doctors don't check that bias at the door, you're not gonna be able to help these folks. And we've gotta break down those barriers. Mm-hmm. And they have been a wonderful resource for us. I believe that we've been a good resource for them. I really do. But I'm trying to carry that, you know, as I have the pulpit at the moment to remind people that suicide is preventable. All of us in the gun owning community could do something about it. We talk about when you're not using your firearms, securely store them.
Absolutely.
Because somebody in your household might be going through a temporary crisis. Just consider it. Think about it.
Well, and a lot of people don't know some of the statistics. So Casey Woods actually exposed me to some of them. The likelihood of a male veteran, I think, was in there also using a firearm for suicide attempt or success. It's like a 90-second window.
Correct.
That if you can avoid that or remove them from their weapons, or like you said, maybe it's not their household and they have access to it and they're in that dark position. If you can get past that, I think the rate goes through the roof.
Correct.
As far as survivability.
Correct. And if you don't go through with it, it's very, very unlikely statistically that you'll do it again.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you have that thought and the thought passes, you're unlikely to die by suicide going forward.
Right.
And talking about suicide does not induce someone to die by suicide.
No.
Which people would have that misconception as well. But again, I've learned all this from AFSP and the VA, and they've got great resources. We have our Have a Brave Conversation literature.
Mm-hmm.
I think AFSP has got Talk Save Lives, and the VA has keepitsecure.gov, which has resources and videos that we actually helped put in input on. Again, from
That's
a gun
amazing.
Owner's perspective,
mm-hmm.
Because again, the doctors, with all due respect, there is a bias that I noticed in some of their literature that said, I'm not comfortable with this. So they agreed to make changes.
Yeah,
it was a great thing.
Well, I appreciate the work that you're doing there, because I think that in the communities that I've been involved with, it's so rampant and it's so terrifying that literally friends will check in with me or get angry with me if I haven't answered to, you know, a signal message like, hey, are you okay? Because in my experience within the last year, I've had about, I think it's at 4 or 5 suicides. And it's the least likely person. You know what I mean? It's the person that's jovial and whatnot. One of the guys, he's done both of the jobs that I have or have had. And it was just one of those time frames where no one had heard from him for a while. And then all of a sudden, something happened, you know, and he's gone.
Right.
So I know that in the veteran community and for everybody listening, check in on your people, you know, talk about these hard subjects. I'm not afraid to do it. I'm an open book, and this is a very, very important thing to me. If I could dedicate all my time to just educating people and doing that, then that would be it. But we have this platform to talk about these things.
Yep.
And now we have people that are, you know, fantastically creating resources for people to reach out and get some help.
And that's what the SHOT Show pays for.
That's
these
amazing.
Types of, you know, yep. these resources, the video assets, all that we do, you know, this is why supporting the SHOT Show is not just about having a gun show or a big celebration of the industry, which it is,
mm-hmm.
but it's also important because the mission of NSSF and all of these safety programs and all of these compliance programs, educating our members about ATF, OSHA compliance, all these things derive from that support from the SHOT Show.
Yeah. It's amazing. I can't thank you enough for the education that you've given me today. I had no idea that there were so many programs that the NSSF and SHOT Show, you know, provided and supported. Obviously, the suicide prevention one is nearest and dearest to my heart, but I think that all the other collective ones, you know, focusing on safety and security, like, it's a lot of things that people don't think about, you know, right. And I think that that shows the compassion within the firearms industry and just trying to make it better, safer, more enjoyable at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
So, where can people find or support? Does NSSF do donations at all, or how does that work?
No, I mean, they can donate to Project Child Safe.
There we go.
That is a 501c3.
Okay, perfect.
ProjectChildSafe.org. We would love your support. That allows us to buy more safety kits, buy more locks, get them out
Beautiful.
To people that really need them.
Yeah.
It's a great program. In fact, right now they're running a sweepstakes. So if we have donors that have kindly donated products so that people that donate above a certain level have a chance at winning a great prize, like a gun or a safe or something like that. So now's the time to look into it.
Yeah.
Sure.
We'll put it in the notes. You can click it and go check it out.
Yeah, that'd be great. But other than that, I mean, you know, because we're not a consumer facing, a lot of people don't know who we are or what mm-hmm. we do. And that's okay. Our members and our industry knows who we are. And, you know, the fact that we have an office on Capitol Hill.
Right.
And, you know, we keep our finger on the pulse of not only what's happening in Congress in Washington, but also at all 50 states and pushing back against bad bills and supporting good bills. Right now we're fighting against discrimination against the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Banks, insurance companies, and so forth are refusing to do business with people in the gun industry.
Really?
So we're getting laws introduced at various legislatures around the country to try and make that illegal. That ought to be illegal.
Mm-hmm.
So we're you know, those are a few of the various things that our government relations folks handle.
Well, and I feel like it's a constant barrage. So you're constantly putting out fires with all these different bills and whatnot. And I feel like sometimes they quietly discriminate against, you know, gun owners or gun businesses, whatnot, you know, through the banks. And I appreciate you guys being so proactive on staying on top of that for the rest of us.
We're fighting the good fight on behalf of the industry because someone has to do it. It's important. You know, we have a tremendously talented crew back at NSSF that literally it's 24/7. When these things pop up in a legislature somewhere out west or out east, or, you know, that we have people that are on it right away. And I think we've got the best folks in the business that are doing it. And I'm very proud of all the work that they do on behalf of the industry that, frankly, I love and have loved now for 4 decades.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you again for, you know, supporting Black Rifle and hosting us. And then for the listeners, we'll be doing SHOT Show specific podcasts throughout that week. And then they will be released almost immediately thereafter. So we'll stay tuned to that. Joe, I can't thank you enough for coming on and talking with us. And I really appreciate everything you do for the industry.
Well, the pleasure is mine. We're so excited to be working with Black Rifle Coffee. You guys have been great, and we're very excited to see you on Radio Row, or we call it Media Row
Media
now.
Media Row, yeah.
We used to call it Radio Row back in the old days.
Yeah.
You know, I'll see you in Vegas, and I hope you have a great show.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks again.
Thank you.
That concludes today's training. Any questions? Woo! Drum titties, boy!